copy of this tape was made by Hugh Taylor in Sacramento, the original by Bill Mitchell of Modesto. This is the annual spring conference of the Northern California Council of Alcoholics Anonymous, held in Richmond, California, March the 14th and 15th of 1970. This is the Saturday night open speaker meeting, and the principal speaker is Dick Heaton from Ventura. This is a complete program.
Hello, AA members, and also to you friends of AA who are here tonight. And greetings also to those fine people who are here and who are associated with Al-Anon and Al-Ateen. My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic. This is the regular Saturday night open AA meeting of the annual spring conference of the Northern California Council of Alcoholics Anonymous. We will open this meeting in the usual manner with a moment of silence, followed by the invocation by the Reverend Palmer Watson of the MacArthur Baptist Church of San Pablo. In the lives of those about us, and for a miracle that has taken place in our own life when we have admitted that we have a problem, when we have admitted that we cannot solve that problem by ourselves, and when we have sought help from Thee. And then, too, Father, we pause to give thanks unto Thee that we have discovered in our own lives that which we try to keep we lose, and that which we share with others, we gain. We're grateful for these who have gathered here this evening. We're grateful for the miracle of new life. We're grateful for the opportunity to share. And we're grateful, O Lord, for the blessings which have come from on high. Be thou very close throughout this meeting, and send us forth from this place determined to live in dedication for others. In Thy name we pray. Amen. I don't know about you, good people who are in Alcoholics Anonymous. I can speak only for myself. But in my boozing days, about the closest I ever got to City Hall was fighting it in my mind, or if the Hall of Justice or the jail happened to be in that vicinity. And I think that this evening, it is rather singular that now that we're sober and gathered together, that the chief executive of our host city is here tonight to welcome us. It is a great privilege for me to present the mayor of the city of Richmond, the Honorable George Livingston. Thank you very much to Mr. McDonald, members of the platform, members of AA and Al-Anon. It's a real pleasure for me to welcome you to our city. Quite often we welcome people to our city, they booze it up, and we have problems. It's a real pleasure for me to welcome someone to our city who is not going to booze it up, and we're not going to have any problems. I had the pleasure of sitting with the members of the organization at the Galileo Club a few minutes ago, to have dinner. I was very impressed to hear some of the comments made by this gentleman that spoke with me in reference to your aim and your goals. He mentioned a person by the name of Bill Wilson. He also mentioned a person by the name of Dr. Bob. I think that great men have passed our way, and it is our responsibility to do something in order to make America better. And listen to some of the comments by this person who is a member of your organization. The goal that you have in mind is to make this a better world in order that every man will have an opportunity to make sure that he's doing something in order that someone else will have a better life. It's a real pleasure for me to welcome such a wonderful group, and I certainly hope you enjoy your meeting here. Thank you very much. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We're self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not affiliated with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. There may be some of you friends of AA here, or there may be some who are kind of window shopping, who are not familiar with our tradition of anonymity at the public level. If so, we respectfully ask that no AA speaker or indeed any AA member be identified by full name in published or broadcast reports of our meetings. We'd like you to understand that this assurance of anonymity is essential in our effort to help other problem drinkers who may wish to share our recovery program. And our tradition of anonymity reminds us that in Alcoholics Anonymous, principles come before personality. And you may wonder what I am doing up here tonight and why I was asked to be chairman. This is an honest program. The head of the conference committee went to the executive of the central office in San Francisco, and he asked for suggestions as to a chairman for tonight. Paul G. said, well, what kind of guy do you want? The chairman says, I want a man with a little authority. Paul said, get Galbraith. He has as little authority as any man I know. I began drinking at the age of 16 because I was insecure and frightened, and had delusions of grandeur at the same time. And occasionally a good belt would make me feel like I was... Who was big at that time? Ronald Coleman, you know, some of these people. Powell, who was that? Other man. And alcohol seemed to do things for me that made me be what I really wanted to be and never could be. The trouble was, it made me terribly sick. Almost from the very beginning, I would go out and have one. And just like the fellow that went out to buy the pair of shoes. Nines fit him, but tens felt so good he got 11s. That's exactly what I did. But as you know, we alcoholics go along in our drinking and get beyond that initial sickness stage and get to the area where we have the hollow leg and take great pride in how much booze we can put away and still drive the rest of the gang home. I went through that, too. And then I began to go through the troubled times that many of us here have gone through. I went through arrests. I went through very embarrassing experiences. I went through the hell of destroying a family that had every right to expect the best, or at least better, from me. And after all this had transpired, it was given to me to come in contact with Alcoholics Anonymous. And all the pain and suffering somehow became worthwhile at that time. And because my higher power selected me, I don't know why, selected you, you don't know why, out of the many millions of alcoholic people in this world to find this organization, I'm able to stand here and kind of smile a little bit and share this evening with you tonight. That's enough about John. We in AA find joy, as you know, in being responsible. The committee which has sponsored this conference has surely been responsible. They've spent much time and a great deal of effort in making this annual spring gathering possible. They have had to spend money in order to do this. As we are self-supporting through our own contribution, let us please remember to be generous as the collection baskets are passed. And is that going to be done now? I believe to take part in the next portion of our program. And that is the reading, the customary reading of Chapter 5 and how it works. And that will be by Bobby S. of San Francisco.
Hi, everybody. In spite of what it says on your program, my name is Bobby, not Sadie, and I am an alcoholic, though. Rarely, how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. But many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose, in a general way, what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, but the result was nil until we let go absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one who has all power. That one is God. Will you find him now? Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Ten, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order. I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholics and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God could and would if he were sought.
And now another customary portion of our program, The Traditions, which will be read by Ben E. of Sacramento.
Thank you. My name is Ben, and I'm a grateful alcoholic. As they told me early when I came to AA, the 12 traditions were to the groups like the steps were for the individuals. The 12 traditions of AA. 1. Our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2. For our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. 3. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. 4. Each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5. Each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6. An AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7. Every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8. Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional. Our service centers may employ special workers. 9. AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues. Hence, the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11. Our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12. Anonymity is the spiritual foundation of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
Ben, thank you very much. There's very little that I could possibly say about our guest speaker for this meeting of the conference. I had thought of trying to introduce him with a little joke, but then I recalled that years ago a man by the name of Walter B. Pitkin claimed that life begins at 40, but also at 40 begins the habit of telling the same joke 3 or 4 times to the same group. So I'm going to forego that. Our guest speaker for this evening is Richard Dick H. of Ventura, California.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Dick Heaton, and I'm an alcoholic. Nice to be here amongst many old friends and so many new friends. I was delighted to hear John explain the reason for our anonymity. In view of that anonymity, I am going to confess to what I think is an open secret, I'm a judge. I hesitate to mention that before AA groups as a rule, because for some reason there is a lack of rapport among the usual AA member and the usual judge. I am at a loss to understand why this should be, because during the course of our drinking careers, most of us as alcoholics come to know one or more or many judges pretty well. This was a matter of the fact that, well, of course, I like this side of the bench better than I did that side. And the matter of my being removed from the association of my alcoholic friends on that side of the bench to this side caused them considerable concern in the early days of my sobriety. And they banded themselves together in a group that is known still, for they have seen no reason to abandon their project. The group was known as the Society for the Encouragement and Preservation of Humility in the Alcoholic Judges of Ventura County. And they tell me stories, and they still tell me stories, and although my life begins at 40, and I know that Pitkin was right, you begin to repeat the story. They are repeated to me, and so I do not hesitate to repeat them to you. And one that is always told to me upon occasions like this, with the suggestion that I preface my remarks with this story so that it will put me in my place, is this. There was a judge, a sweet, kind, lovable old alcoholic judge, as we all are, who had before him for sentence a large Negro defendant. And he had known this black man a long time, and they knew each other well. And upon this occasion, he said, "Seymour," he said, "I've got to sentence you again." He said, "And this time it was pretty bad." He said, "You beat up that fellow. You just beat him up pretty bad." He said, "Now," he said, "have you got anything to say in mitigation before I pass sentence?" And Seymour says, "Mitigation?" He says, "What's that?" He says, "Well, excuse. Have you got a? Did he say anything to provoke you?" He said, "Did he say anything to provoke me?" "Judge, he called me a big black son of a bitch. What would you do if somebody called you a big black son of a bitch?" And the judge says, "Well, I'm not a big black son of a bitch." And Seymour said, "Yeah, but suppose he calls you the kind of a son of a bitch you is." I was unable to clear that story with the mayor before he left. I did clear it with Harvey, however, who is a higher authority as far as I'm concerned. I have also, I say it for a good reason. This being, I think, a meeting at which there are others than those of us closely knit in the fraternity and fellowship of AA, I say it to indicate that alcoholism is no respecter of persons, because it doesn't make any difference whether you're black or white or young or old or rich or poor or male or female or tall or short or high or low in the social scale, in or out, well or sick. These things make any difference at all as we are objectively viewed. The things that bring us together are the identical things, the common denominators of our disease, and the differences among us that we have, as all human beings have, are not really important to us. The really important things are the common denominators of our disease, which spill over into the common denominators of our recovery. I have another reminder of humility that I think perhaps is pat here. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a violent, belligerent atheist. I not only didn't believe in God, I didn't believe there was a God, I didn't believe anybody else believed in God, and I believed the people who said they believed in God were nuts. That they had some sort of mental hypnosis or something that was satisfying to their low candle power brains, but it didn't suit me at all. And as a fallen away atheist, I have been a little slow in adopting some of the prayers that are now most dear to me. And one of the dearest is one that is probably the second best known of St. Francis's prayer. And most of us in AA get to know the first and best known of St. Francis's prayers because it's in the 12 steps and 12 traditions, and many of us use it as the beginning of the taking of our inventory and the beginning of our meditations. But the second best known, it goes something like this. Blessed is he who thinks himself none the better. When people make much over him and exalt him, and when they hold him to be worthless, ordinary, and contemptible. For what a person is before God, so much is he, and no more. Now, this is another reminder that we, as alcoholics, and in the course of our recovery, are not recovering by reason of our individual personalities, characters, efforts, volition, or achievements. It's something that is given to us. And as John pointed out, why is inexplicable. As I look around this room, I am satisfied that my God has a sense of humor. I can't imagine his picking out a bunch like us to give us sobriety when there are obviously people who are more deserving. So it isn't a question of deserving it. In the early days of this program, I did all I could to complicate it. In that connection, I might tell another little story that my group passes on to me from time to time. This has to do with another judge who was asked by a couple who brought with them their 7-year-old son if he wouldn't marry them. They thought it was time to get married, and he agreed with them. So that he asked for the license, and they produced the license, and he looked at the sheet, and it said, is your name John Charles Carter? And he says, no, it's John Carl Carter. He says, well, it's a technicality, but you go back to the clerk and get it straightened out. He came back and he looked at the license again and he said to the woman, were you born in 1942? And she said, no, I was born in 1941. He said, well, it's a technicality, but take it back to the clerk and get it straightened out. This happened 4 or 5 times, and when at last it was straightened out, he performed the ceremony, and as they were leaving, he told them, he said, well, your status is now impeccable. You are absolutely married, and there's no question about it. He said, this little chap here, unfortunately, will always be a technical bastard. And they burst into smiles, and he said, no, he said, you don't understand. He said, you're married, all right, but there's nothing I can do about that. This little chap will remain the rest of his life a technical bastard. And they smiled again. He said, you don't understand. You'd think I were paying you a compliment. They said, well, no matter what you say, Judge, you are paying us a compliment. You couldn't pay us a higher compliment than to call this chap a technical bastard because that's what the clerk said you was. Well, I was. I spent an awful lot of time in the early days of this program with the technicalities of it. And it was only a couple of months ago that I heard a proper description of this process and the means to avoid it. I was one of those people who had, in the euphemism, I had a little trouble with this program. Some of you know there were 23 months between my admission day and my confirmation day in Alcoholics Anonymous. And during that 23 months, I was busily revising the program, commenting on it, analyzing it, parsing it, modifying it and amending it so that it would be suitable for me and my particular special brand of alcoholism. And I was drunk all the time. And I never realized later what this sort of being a technical person could do to you until, as I say, not long ago, I heard a very apt motto. It seems that somebody else who had had this tendency to revise the program for his personal needs without success had a real hard-boiled engineer as a sponsor. And the engineer, viewing these efforts of this young man, new to the program, busily making it over, said, we have an old engineering adage, a motto, a precept that we apply to all mechanical things, and I suggest you apply it to Alcoholics Anonymous and its program. And that motto is, if it works, don't fix it. That's just superb. This program works, or you and I wouldn't be here, because most of us don't know how it works or pretend to understand it. We do it, and we get well. It would be presumptuous, it seems to me, and it is perhaps a little, for those of us in Alcoholics Anonymous to speak to each other as I am doing to you now. If I were to do anything more than to show you confirmed in my experience, as you show those around you confirmed in yours, the efficacy of our program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's one of my fancies that all of the alcoholics in history who recover from our disease follow exactly the same course. Now, we, objectively viewed, are as different as all human beings can be. The things that we did to get to Alcoholics Anonymous, as we are, as someone else looks at them, may appear to be vastly different. But basically, we're the same. In the fundamentals, we're the same. In the things that cause us to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, to stay here and get well, we are the same. And these things can be observed. We can read about them in the book. In fact, if you were attentive when I and Ben were reading, you know all there is to know about intellectually about Alcoholics Anonymous and the fellowship and the way it works. But this isn't enough for most of us. We have to live in the climate and company of Alcoholics Anonymous to see and feel and be what it really is. You know, prior to Bill W. and Dr. Bob and this wonderful fellowship with which we now surround ourselves, prior to that time, almost no one had ever recovered from alcoholism. There were occasional instances that made ecclesiastical and medical and psychiatric history. They were so rare. But by and large, the alcoholic went insane or died or both, and there was no way out. There were sometimes occasions of enforced sobriety, but this was all. No one got well. Certainly not in substantial numbers. And now we do get well in substantial numbers. Not large enough by any means, but in substantial numbers. Because in rooms like this and smaller and all over the world now, there are people like us coming together to share our experience and our strength and our hope and ultimately our great joy in the practical recovery from alcoholism that is given to us by our program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think we do the same things that the first 100 alcoholics in history did. You know, for the first time in history, on the first 100 alcoholics in history whose experiences were, pardon the expression, distilled and put into this book, they deduced what was wrong with us, they deduced what happened to us, and in my view, they all did the same things in essence, and we who are well are doing the same things in essence. And they're summed up in those ABCs that were at the conclusion of this portion of Chapter 5 that was read tonight. Something like this, it says, our description of the alcoholic, our chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after, I love adventures for what happened before, make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and couldn't manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could relieve our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. Now, at one stage or another, in the course of our development from drinking alcoholics to sober alcoholics, it's my view that we follow this path of the ABCs. I don't qualify at great length anymore. The description of my drinking career might interest you. You would see some parallels in it, perhaps. But it wouldn't do you any good. But it did me a lot of good. My own experience was essential for what happened to me, just as yours is essential for what happened to you, in order to bring you to the gates of Alcoholics Anonymous, willing to go to any length to get what we have. Now, we have a lot of fun around AA and in our meetings and after our meetings, telling what happened to us, and there are enough parallels in our experience so that, as the sociologists say, we have no trouble identifying with each other. But our experience, our individual personal experience, objectively viewed, can be widely different. But in essence, it does the same thing for us. It brings us to the point where we are, A, realize that we're alcoholic and can't manage our own lives, and B, we have exhausted all of the human resources, all of the human resources that we can find and that can be offered to us. And then when we get well, we must of necessity explain our sobriety upon the basis of the God that we have come to understand, a power superior to any human power, because human power isn't enough. If it were enough, we wouldn't even be here. You know, I think we have a larger number, really, of non-alcoholic people at our alcoholic meeting here tonight than we usually do. And I want to say a word of gratitude to you non-alcoholics. None of us who is alcoholic comes to this program without the concern, the interest, the efforts, of one or more many non-alcoholics. Some of the things you do to get us here aren't always palatable, but we need it, because whatever happened to us is what we needed to get here. And I am particularly grateful to a number of non-alcoholic people, and I know that all of us in the program are. And with that, let me tell you why it is so difficult for you to look at us, you non-alcoholics, and for us to look at you with any idea of understanding at all. Not to put too fine a point on it, we're different. One of the reasons that our book says that one of the reasons that it's difficult for us to admit that we are alcoholics is that no one likes to admit that he is bodily and mentally different from his fellows. And this is exactly what we are. We are not like you bodily, and we are not like you mentally. There are two aspects of our disease, and they go hand in hand to bring us here. Neither one alone really doesn't make us an alcoholic. Whereas the book says in one place, a real alcoholic. I've never understood what a real alcoholic was. But anyway, we are bodily and mentally different from our fellows. I'm not going to bore you with a lot of statistics. I don't like them very well. But I think that these things are observable. The people who are in this room are interested in booze and what it does to people. We're a pretty expert bunch so far as our knowledge of alcoholism is concerned, and I merely invite your attention to the fact. If you look around you, you'll see the only statistics that I'm going to give you. You'll see that one out of two American adults drinks booze. And that of those who drink booze, one out of ten is an alcoholic. Now, that's a kind of a loose, easy figure. It may be one out of 12 in Ventura and one out of 8 in Richmond. But it's a good round number. For every one of us alcoholics, there are 9 people who drink who aren't alcoholics. And this explains our trouble. You outnumber us. You make the laws and you enforce the laws and you're right and we're wrong. And I used to resent this terribly until I thought of how it might be if it were the other way around. That would be something, wouldn't it? Imagine if the alcoholics outnumbered the non-alcoholics 9-1 and we were working at it. Anyway, we are in these two areas different from you. Now, this thing runs through all of our disease and all of our programs, bodily and mentally, physically and non-physically. The book puts it in several ways. The bodily and mentally that I mentioned, the suggestion that our physical defect may be something in the nature of an allergy, and that we may have an obsession of the mind. We speak of grave emotional and mental disorders, and of an intolerance and inability to drink like other people, which is a physical thing. And the beauty of this program is that it can be observed. It's practical. There's nothing theoretical or abstract about it at all. You can't fail to understand it. As a matter of fact, you can't even understand it. All you can do is look at it and do it. And if you look at this classification, the 9 people who drink and don't get in trouble and us, who's the 1 out of 10 who does, we have these two distinctions, bodily and mentally. Now, if you look at alcoholics, they fall roughly into two classes, drunk and sober. Or I should say, sober and non-sober. We aren't always drunk. Sometimes we're getting drunk, on the way to getting drunk, sick because we were drunk because we were sick. We don't always get in trouble, if you've been there, you know, and if you've observed it, you think you know. This is another distinction between us alcoholics and you non-alcoholics. I think it was yesterday I saw in the Metropolitan Southern California papers a reference to the fact that alcoholism costs the county of Los Angeles $73 million a year. And divided up, that's roughly $10 a head for every man, woman, and child. And divided it up more practically, it's roughly between $400 and $500 for every alcoholic. And the non-alcoholics look at this and say, why should I pay $400 or $500 for people like you? And we look at it and say, well, why didn't I get my share? We have some differences. Now, if you look at alcoholics who are sober, one astonishing thing is apparent. And it took me about 4 or 5 years of sobriety before this really impressed upon me with its full import. And that is that the sober alcoholic doesn't drink. And that the drunk alcoholic does. And that's all there is to it. Some years ago, as a matter of fact, it was in 1952, when my fat friend from Santa Paula and I were voted the most unlikely to succeed in Alcoholics Anonymous, and Willard was captured and taken to our local mental institution down there, Camarillo State Hospital, and this is one of the reasons I have the longest birthday in history, AA birthday. When he went into the hospital, we were both drunk, And when he came out, we were both sober, 90 days later. Now, I don't know when during that 90 days I had my last drink, but Weird is kind enough to share his experience physically. He even shared his number with me. I am known in Ventura County as number 30,756.5. Anyway, when Willard got out of the hospital, he was one of these people who was greatly concerned about why he drank. He'd had an Austrian psychiatrist in the hospital who kept bugging him, saying, "Why do you drink? Why do you drink?" And he wasn't drinking anymore, but he was really concerned about why did he drink. So we read everything there was that the science could give us. And sometime after that, 3 or 4 years, we came across a study that had been made by two men of science at Harvard. I think one of them was a pathologist and one of them was a biochemist. And they'd spent about 5 years and examined 1,500 alcoholics in a search for the cause and treatment of alcoholism. And Eureka, they had found it, and they announced it. And we were delighted to get this information. They discovered that the cause of alcoholism is drinking and that the objective of treatment is total abstinence. You know, they're right. And in my most recent studies, I am sorry to state that the scientific knowledge hasn't advanced beyond that. Right now, what we know about alcoholism on the physical side is that the cause is drinking and that the treatment is not to drink. And there isn't anything else to do. And the first great feeling of comfort that can come to many of us alcoholics is the realization that this is so. That there is nothing further to argue or debate about whether or not we drink, when we drink, what we drink, whether or not we're going to get away with it this time, whether this time is going to be different. None of these things are relevant to our problem at all. Our problem is solved on the physical side. And this is so simple that it escapes us all for a long time, and some of us forever. But that's all there is to it. And this is why we have our first step where it is. This is why the only requirement for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous is a desire to stop drinking. This is why the A of the ABCs is the A. This is where we start, by not drinking. My medical friends tell me that we have a very peculiar disease. My wife used to tell me that, too. We have a very peculiar disease in this. That it is one of the few, if not the only one, where you have to treat the symptom before you can treat the disease. You'll remember that our book says that our drinking was often but a symptom of deep-seated mental and emotional disorders. And this is probably so. But before you can treat the mental and emotional disorders, you've got to treat the symptoms. That is, you've got to knock it off. It begins there. It doesn't begin after the treatment of the mental and emotional disorders. This is why the poor clergy have so much trouble with us. Why the psychiatrists have so much trouble with us. You've got to treat our symptom before you can treat our disease. And it doesn't do us much good to begin to grow spiritually or begin to get the bugs out of our character if we continue to drink. And in fact, it doesn't work at all. I know of no instance. No instance where anybody got well by doing something else before he quit drinking. It's essential. We make it possible in Alcoholics Anonymous by making it the business of our life, not to take one drink one day at a time. And that's all there is to it. There isn't anything else, and if you do anything else, if you drink, well, you never get to this. It's so important, and it's so subtle, really, to us alcoholics. Now, you non-alcoholics do this all the time. You all say, "Why don't you knock it off? Quit drinking. You wouldn't have any trouble." And we won't, and we don't. But we aren't able to do this. It lends itself to a very simple life, too. We alcoholics have a tendency to grow rather smug, and we ask you non-alcoholics to forgive us this, as you have forgiven us so much else. I recall my wife some time ago when the children were seated around the breakfast table, and she would be a little agitated, and she'd say, "Kids, look at him. There he is. He's got an incurable, progressive, terminal, loathsome," this was her idea, "disease. He's the happiest man I know. He hasn't got a thing to do all day except keep from taking a drink." I've got to get your lunches ready. I've got to get you off to school. I've got to do the washing. I've got to do the ironing. I've got to do the mending. I've got to do the cleaning. Him? Nothing. All day, except not take a drink. And that's right. And that's all that I have to do today. And I have nothing else that's in the same category or dimension, but not to take a drink. If I do that, I'm going to be sober, or at least I'm going to be chemically pure, and I'm going to have what's left of me to do what is required of me by this program to make me the kind of a person who has the power not to drink. And this is the way it works. It's an astonishing thing. Now, if you don't take a drink, and you are chemically pure, you can turn your attention to the practice of the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in all of your affairs. And by some mystery and miracle, a joyous mystery and miracle that I don't understand, and I don't want to understand it, because when I understood things, I always lost them up. I don't understand this at all. But if you do these things, then whatever is required in your particular case is given to you. We come with various character defects, with various mental and emotional disorders, with various things wrong with us, in different degrees in each of us. Essentially, they're the same thing. We are, well, again, not to put too fine a point on it, our disease is a combination of this intolerance for booze and the inability to cope with life. Whether you call it emotional and mental disorders or personality defects or character defects or whatever you call it or whether you don't call it anything at all, we're the kind of people that can't cope with life. And this gives us our vicious circle of alcoholism. We can't cope, so we drink. And if we drink, we can cope even less. And the less we cope, the more we drink, the less we can cope. And if I... Well, you've been there. And if you haven't been there, I couldn't tell you about it anyhow. So, when we have this... This is the combination of things that constitutes our disease that brings us to this program. We have these two things together. Either of them alone apparently isn't enough. We can have a bad drinking habit. We can have almost an addiction to booze, but if we aren't goofed up somewhere in the mental department, we get by pretty well. And on the other hand, if we don't have the allergy to the booze, we can be like the average non-alcoholic, living the life of quiet desperation that many of you live. We don't have that choice. You know, things get so tough for us that we'd rather be dead, so we're going to do something. And you don't have to do that if you're a non-alcoholic. But these things in combination constitute our disease, and there's no approach to it except to put the cork in the jug as the first step. And this gets to be the business of our life. So, we don't drink. Then whatever is left of us, and it often isn't very much, whatever is left of us, we turn over to this program, and we practice these principles as best we can in the climate and company of Alcoholics Anonymous members so that we will keep our focus on the things that we've got to keep our focus on. Because habit is a very strong thing, and it's very easy for us to slip back into being the kind of people that we used to be. And if we get to be the kind of people that we used to be, we get drunk again. This accounts to me in a very simple fashion for our slips or our relapses. Many of us have had the experience of a brief period of sobriety or chemical purity or freedom from the physical effects of alcohol. I had 9 of my 23 months in just that fashion. I was happy, I thought, because here I was. I wasn't getting any trouble. I felt pretty good. Things were beginning to look a little bit better. I got drunk because I was the same guy. And if you're the same person, you can't cope with life. And when you can't cope with life, you're going to drink. And if you drink and you've got the kind of a reaction to booze that I have, the chemistry takes hold. A good description of it is that we're the kind of people on the physical side who, when we have a drink, the drink needs a drink. And it may not need it right away, but it's going to need it pretty quick. It's going to need it before we need it, believe me. And this is the vicious part of the physical side of our disease. And this is why we knock off the drink to start this thing. Then when we've knocked it off, we're sober. However, we're chemically pure. Your health, sir. 15 years and I still smell it. I don't know whether you thought my speech was dry or I was. The mental and emotional disorders with which we come to the program, coupled with this physical disease, these are the things that yield to the treatment of our program. And if we don't drink, We have all day to do the things that are proven by the people who wrote this book, proven by the experience of everyone around us to whom we're attentive and who is sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, to be the way out, to give us the kind of character that enables us not to take a drink. I still spend a great deal of time in institutional meetings, and I delight in it. I think there's nothing more dramatic than the things that happen to me when I'm on the outside at a meeting like this. Invariably, somebody will come up to me and say, "Don't you remember me?" And I'll say, "No, I remember you." And they'll say, "Well, I saw you at the hospital in 52 or 58 or 64 or 68 or last month. Don't you remember me?" And I'll say, "No, you're a different person." And he or she is a different person. They are now the kind of people that don't have to drink. And when we came to Alcoholics Anonymous, we were without exception the kind of people who had no choice. Because our emotional and mental disorders, our non-physical makeup, compelled us to drink. And the drink that we took compelled us to take another drink, and we were in that vicious circle. And our sobriety results in a benign circle, because if we don't drink, we're sober. And if we're sober, we have the capacity to do all day, to practice the principles of this program in all our affairs, which gives us the power to keep from taking the drink that renders us sober and able to do all of the things that will enable us to have the power to keep from taking a drink, keeping from taking it gives us the power and so forth forever, I hope. And it's a delightful substitution. And it's not easy. It's awesomely difficult. It's almost impossible. Most of us find it wholly impossible without the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. In this company, in this fellowship, we, for some reason that I now ascribe to a power superior to a human power, we get to the point where we have a power that enables us to keep from taking a drink. And keeping from taking the drink develops us along these lines. Now, whatever is wrong with us, and it's different for most of us, after I had abandoned my atheistic enthusiasm and began to look at some of these things, I discovered there were seven deadly sins. I'd been practicing them, but I couldn't categorize them. I find that this is still a very convenient way to take my inventory. And, of course, I borrowed this from the 12 and 12, too. But if you undertake to practice the principles of this program in all of your affairs, whatever emphasis you personally have put on any one or more or all of the seven deadly sins, that particular aspect is for you or for me treated. So just as our drinking experience may have seemed superficially different, so our recovery may seem superficially different. But basically the same things happen to us. We realize without any question, without any debate, with an absolute conviction, with an acceptance as distinguished from a mere affirmation or asseveration, the realization, beyond doubt, that our physical life depends upon not taking a drink. And then we begin to practice these principles in our affairs, and whatever happens to us then takes care of our character defect. I think the old-fashioned revivalist would say that in order to be this kind of a different kind of a person, you have a conversion, which means to turn about. I'm still close enough to my atheism, so I'm not enthusiastic about the terms of organized religion, but I can accept the conversion. The modern psychiatrist would probably say that we have a personality change. I like that better. In AA, we say we have a spiritual awakening or a spiritual experience, and I like that even better. Many of us don't ever have a word for what happens to us, just as we never have a word for what we are, or where we came from, or what our disease is like. Since there are some of you here who may not be as familiar with our course in Alcoholics Anonymous as some others, you may be questioning whether or not you're an alcoholic. And most of us did. It's, as I say, nobody likes to admit he's bodily and mentally different from his fellows. But you don't need to be concerned about whether or not you're an alcoholic. If you are interested in what we have, you don't even have to say you're an alcoholic. In fact, lots of us around here don't say it except after as we get well. I like to say it now because it's a description of me. It tells you about the physical side of my disease. I can't drink. Those of you who take the grapevine will remember that cartoon a couple of months ago. I think it was a beautiful thing. And where the fellow says, "I never drink when I'm sober." Perfect description of us. So that... If you are under any illusions that you may not want this program or aren't ready for it because you can't define your alcoholism, forget it. There are lots of definitions of alcoholism, and in the old days when I was searching for one that fit me, I couldn't find it. But I stored up a number of them, and I now have concluded that I never heard one that didn't fit me to a T. So that if you would like to borrow one or two of these, examine them. I like best the one that our first Catholic priest in Alcoholics Anonymous gave us. He said something like this, that an alcoholic is one who, having had one drink, cannot guarantee his behavior. Perfect description, because you don't always get drunk right away, but one drink renders you unpredictable, especially if it's important for you to do something. If you make a promise to do something, you're undoubtedly going to take a drink, and then your behavior is unpredictable. You can't guarantee it. And this is the story of all of it. The sociologist's definition that if you're a social problem, you're an alcoholic. And a social problem is one who gets into trouble by reason of his drinking. If your wife tells you you drink too much, you're an alcoholic. The wives of people who don't drink too much don't tell them that. Astonishing, isn't it? The nicest one is if you have a drinking problem, you're an alcoholic. Non-alcoholics don't have drinking problems. You know, if somebody tells a non-alcoholic you're spending too much money on booze, knocks off, he says, you're right, dear, and quits. And our wives tell us, you're spending too much on booze, dear, and we say, you're right, dear, I'll knock it off, and we go right on drinking. This is the distinction. There's another one that some of the judges told me one time. They said an alcoholic is one whose drinking makes him unhappy. If you think about that, they're right. The average non-alcoholic drinks because it makes him happy. They get hilarious when they drink. You know, you've seen them on New Year's Eve. They go out and just have a ball. But I never knew anyone who came into Alcoholics Anonymous because he was happy. We come in because we're desperately unhappy. Well, what happens to us when we devote our lives to this, the practice of these principles in all our affairs? You heard it said here, as it says right after the 12 steps, many of us exclaimed, what an order. That is, it's a big job. It requires nothing less than a complete change of the kind of people that we used to be. And we can't volitionally say, I'm going to be different, and be different. At least I couldn't. Most of us can't. But we can volitionally say, I'm going to do the things that are suggested in this program, and then for some reason we become different. In my own case, at the point of the A's, when I was at last aware that I was alcoholic and couldn't manage my own life, I was impeded by my atheism. I never got to that B business. I couldn't believe that probably no human power could relieve my alcoholism until I had tried all of the human powers that I could find and that were available to me. I was a child prodigy. I didn't hang around until I was 16 like John here before I started to drink. I was a college man when I was 15. And I was a good drinker in those days. A child prodigy, as many of you know, is someone who knows more as a child than he does after he grows up. And but I was a child prodigy, and I'm a genius. I know all that you, all you alcoholics think you're geniuses, but I'm a certified genius, really. I'm a Stanford Terman baby, and an IQ of 170, and Phi Beta Kappa, and Order of the Coif, and Magna Cum Laude from a couple of universities, and a couple of law schools, and a really smart cookie. I've got a whole wall full of plaques that tell you how smart I am. And really, the only stupid thing I ever did was to believe it. But here I was, a genius, you understand? And my thought was that the greatest power in the universe was man's reason. And in my modest fashion, I thought that my own personal reason was the epitome of mankind. And I didn't need anything else. And that illusion almost killed me. As a matter of fact, I was one of these characters, you know, in my atheism, I'd say, if there's a God, let him strike me down. Nothing ever happened. I learned later he was doing it by degrees. Just made it into AA in time. Anyway, some of you know what I now look back upon as what must have been my spiritual awakening came to me under my bed. I no longer trusted those dizzy heights, and I was under that bed contemplating the cobwebs, and I said to myself, as I had every morning for 23 months, I'm an alcoholic. And then I thought, well, by God, I am an alcoholic. And it meant to me then what it means to me now. That I was utterly and hopelessly insane. Here I was, the greatest man on earth. A wise, charming, personable, rich, all in my imagination. And I was going to do something that I didn't want to do. I was going to be drunk by 11 o'clock in the morning. And I desperately wanted not to be drunk at 11 o'clock in the morning. And so I bethought myself of the people around me. I had 9 sponsors. You wear out a lot of 9 sponsors in 23 months. I thought of some of these sponsors, the people that I had disparaged, some of them we've been discussing here tonight. Good old George M. used to bug me. George M. was a good Irishman, and when you said to him, what keeps you sober, he'd say, well, God keeps me sober. When I asked him in the morning not to let me take a drink, I can't take one. And I thought, you poor, ignorant leprechaun, you don't know what you've got. We had a little guy named Louis A., and I used to say to him, what keeps you sober? And he says, I say into the mirror, I say, look, Louis, today you get no damn drink because God won't let you. And I thought, oh, Louis, you know, not for me. Under my bed, it dawned on me that here I had been caviling and criticizing these people, and they, without exception, were sober, and I, without exception, was drunk. So, while I couldn't believe, I figured that if at last I was going to survive, I had better at least try to see if what they had working for them wouldn't work for me. And that's really all I did. I was never able to say, I got it. I was never able to say, I'm now going to believe in God and God's going to keep me sober. It didn't work that way for me. And I understand it doesn't work for a lot of other people who come with spiritual poverty to this program. And in some sense, we all come in that fashion. But in this particular area, I had personally exhausted all of the human resources that I could think of. I'd used all the ones in chapter 3 about the limitation of drinking. I'd studied all of the philosophies and religions of mankind in the hope that I could avoid using one of them. I had done everything that there was that you could do on a human level to keep from taking a drink, and there wasn't anything. And so at last, under the bed, was what the book calls the open mind of the dying. I began to look at what I had always seen. Sober alcoholic. And why were they sober? They didn't drink. And why didn't they drink? Because they had something that I didn't have that enabled them to keep from taking a drink. And I struck the probably right then and there. No human power can relieve our alcoholism. And of course, the C is just the frosting on the cake. It's just a description of what happens to us, that God could and would if he were sought. Now, I don't want to startle any of you who have the same spiritual poverty that I had when I came, who entertain agnosticism or atheism, or who even think that the God that you believe isn't suitable for your particular purpose in the connection with alcohol. None of these things is important to me, nor to you, really. But the only explanation to me of sobriety of an alcoholic is that it's beyond the human power, and if you're sober, you've got something that's beyond the human power. Well, we may put it, before I came to AA, I had to drink, and now I don't have to. Before I came to AA, I was relying upon a human power. Now I don't have to drink. What have I got? This sort of thing. I suppose that there are as many spiritual views among us as there are members of Alcoholics Anonymous. But I suspect that somewhere in the contents of the spiritual views that each of us has, it is the realization that there here, a part of it at least, if not the whole thing, is the power that keeps alcoholics sober, or keeps me sober. This is where it began with me. That's an extraordinarily difficult thing to do. It's almost impossible unless we do it with each other. You know how it used to be said, somebody would say, well, can't I keep sober without going to all those meetings? And your sponsor says, yeah, you can, but you won't. This sort of thing, I can't stay sober, but we can. The sharing of our experience, our strength, and our hope is essential to us to keep our spiritual focus and to keep us reminded that we are different from the 9 out of 10 people who are different from us in the consequential things of life. If we want it badly enough, and this is why our desire to stop drinking comes first, and this isn't an ordinary common garden variety of desire. It isn't in the same category with any other human wish or motive. This is first. Nothing is more important than not taking a drink. I start each day. Some of you know I like this. Not everybody does, but I wake each morning with the realization that I ought to be dead. If you're an alcoholic, you ought to be dead too. I didn't survive through any merit or achievement or volition of my own. I was one of these people that drew blanks. I lived most of my, well, half of my life, I know about only through hearsay. I got a lot of it off of police blotters and hospital records from a loving wife who took shorthand. Incidentally, she's here tonight, and I don't often get a chance to get even with her in this fashion. We were discussing the other day. I said to her, I said, "Why in God's name did you put up with me during those years?" And she said, "I was stupid." And I looked at her, and she said, "No, no," she said, "I really wasn't so stupid. I was ignorant." "No," she said, "I was ignorant because I was stupid." She said, I didn't know what was the matter with you. I didn't realize how bad you were. When you came home and you said you were tired and you passed out, I rejoiced because you were getting some rest. And besides," she said, "you showed your best nature in that state. I knew where you were." And in those days, she said, "I didn't know what was the matter with you." She said, "If I had, I probably wouldn't have put up with it." Unfortunately, she did. And we have some sort of a milestone now, because about this time, considering my long birthday, we will have lived together while I was sober as long as we lived together while I was drunk. Anyway, the people who see us before are aware of a change in us, often before we are aware of it ourselves. Now, the explanation of this is, I believe, in the practice of the principles of our program. And it is an extraordinarily difficult thing. It is an order. What an order it is. Dr. Bob was aware of this, and I love to think back upon one of the things that's attributed to him. It was said that Dr. Bob said, "Let's keep it simple. Let's not louse it up. Let's remember that it's a program of love and of service." And so it is. And I had a friend that I met in one of the mental hospitals not too long ago, who died not too long ago sober, who lived his entire life saying after this, he said, "Even love and service is too complicated for me. I'm just going to live a life of being as kind to everybody as I can every day." And these things will work. If you practice these principles in all your affairs, if you live a life of love and service, or if you're as kind to everyone as you can be every day, it renders us the kind of a person who doesn't have to take a drink. It gives us a power beyond human power, because that's what it takes for us to keep from taking a drink. And those of us in this state of spiritual poverty, you don't have to worry about it. I did for a while, but you needn't. This has been a not uncommon experience among us. Somebody that I met not too long ago said that he had a sponsor who very wisely handled it in this fashion. He was another fallen away atheist. And he went to his sponsor and he says, "I'm doing pretty well." He says, "I'm sober. I've got almost a year, a little over a year sober." He said, "But do I have to believe in God?" And his sponsor, a wise old man who had a similar experience of falling away from atheism, says, "Yes, you do, but not yet." And this is the solution. As a matter of fact, I've heard the second step referred to as the atheist step. It's not one that you take. It's one that happens to you. And if you practice the principles of this program, you, in the second step, come to believe, we came to believe, that a power greater than a human power could restore us to sanity and hence to sobriety. And this, I think, is the explanation of what happens to us. Now, as I say, it's extraordinarily and awesomely difficult. We can't do it alone. I tell us how to do it in the book. You know, we tell a newcomer that there are no musts in AA. This is to kind of win you over. You know, we've heard so many musts when we get here that we can't stand another one. In fact, I'm still rebellious enough so that if somebody tells me to do something, I ain't going to do it. Even if I want to do it, I won't do it. And this is after a long period of sobriety. So if you're new, forget that must business and listen for the word indispensable. Later you'll find out there isn't any difference. But right now, you don't must anything. But there are certain indispensables, and they are subtly approached in this book. It's a delightful way they handle it. In the first edition, they put an asterisk after spiritual experience. And you know, after you've been sober about 4 months, you can see that asterisk. After you've been sober about 4 months later, you could read the footnote, which was in the smallest type they had. It said, "See Appendix A." And after about another 4 months, and you've read all the stories once again, you've found your way over to Appendix A, and there it is. It said, "We've been compelled throughout this book to speak of a spiritual experience and a spiritual awakening. Not many of us had the blinding flash or revelation type of spiritual awakening that Bill W. and some of the others did, whose stories are in the book. Most of us had what the psychologist William James called the educational variety of religious or spiritual experience, an unfolding, an awakening, a progress, something that was apparent in others, to others in us before we were aware of it. But it says, if you practice the principles of this program honestly, open-mindedly, and willingly, it's inevitable, that you will have the power to keep from taking a drink and the spiritual awakening that's mentioned in the book. But it says these three are indispensable. So we must be as honest as we can, as open-minded as we can, and as willing as we can. As many of you know, sometimes this is called the How of AA for the initials, the H for honesty, the O for open-mindedness, and the W for willingness. And if we are kind, or if we live a life of love and service, or if we practice the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in all our affairs, honestly, open-mindedly, and willingly, we get well. And we stay well. And we come to explain our sobriety on the basis of a power superior to a human power. And we come through the course and practice of the 11th step to find great joy in this, because we seek knowledge only of this power for us and the power of the power to carry it out. And even old atheists like me come without embarrassment and with great joy to call this power the God that I have come to understand. And to me, it's the only explanation for my sobriety and for yours. And it isn't something that I can demand or achieve or seek out or volitionally obtain. It's something that happens to me. And it happens to me as a result of honestly, open-mindedly, and willingly practicing the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in my affairs. And it is a development from that beginning that makes our life as beautiful as it is. If we're honest and we analyze the troubles that we had when we came to Alcoholics Anonymous, they were all bottomed on our drinking. And if we're honest when we come to analyze the good things that happened to us after we come to Alcoholics Anonymous, they're all bottomed on our sobriety. Just as volitionally we couldn't do anything about our drinking or about our problems or about our troubles when we were drinking, so now there isn't very much that we can do about achieving the goals that we set for ourselves. We don't set any after we get along in this program because we're not smart enough to know what's good for us. At least I'm not. I ask this God that I have come to understand what's good for me. You do my thinking. I'll do the footwork, and if the footwork gets pretty heavy, give me the power to do that. This is the life. And as one of my friends says, if it'll work for your life, it'll work for a nickel, and it'll work for everything. And this is what most of us come to enjoy in this life. And good things do happen to us on the basis of our sobriety. I don't emphasize these to you who are new because I didn't emphasize them to me. I didn't come for anything other than sobriety. It never occurred to me that there could be some good things. I just wanted to get even. It never occurred to me that I could be anything better than just even. And things haven't happened that way. Things have gotten much better. And so long as I can remember to keep my will and my life turned over, these things continue to happen. But it isn't easy. When I say honest, open-minded, and willing, I don't mean that you have to be honest. After all, how could we alcoholics be honest? I mean that you have to be as honest as you can be at any given state in your development. And again, objectively viewed, this may not be much. People look around, I know they never do it in the Northern Conference, but occasionally we take somebody's inventory down south. And among the things that is the most futile, as well as everything else in our practice, is for me to look at you and say, you're not practicing this program right. You're going to get drunk. Or if I acted like you, I'd be drunk. What difference does it make? It's none of my business. I can say, you're not honest. And this guy will say, well, you should have seen me 10 years ago, but right now I'm as honest as I can be and as willing as I can be and as open-minded. And this is what it takes at any given state in our development, and it doesn't have to be too good. I'm going to conclude with a brief sermon. I hope you'll forgive me. It was given to me by my last sponsor, one that is probably dearest to me of all. He was another fallen-away atheist. I used to call myself his Japanese wife. I followed respectfully behind him at 9 paces. And one day toward the end of my drinking, I had had another adventure. I had run into a truck on the Grapevine, one of these great big things with Christmas tree lights all over it that you can't see. And I'd broken a kneecap, among other things, and I was lying at home on my bed of pain, and good old Max used to come up every day. And he did everything. He went down and opened the office, he got the mail, he took the kids to school, he did the family marketing. He just did everything for me, and then besides that, he sat at my sick bed. And so one afternoon, to make conversation more than anything else, I said to Max, you're almost a saint. I said, why do you do all these things for me? And I thought he was going to say, well, he said, you're a pretty good guy, and smart and all that sort of thing. If we ever get you sobered up, you'll land a little class, AA. He didn't say that. I said, why do you do all these things for me? And he says, it isn't because I like you, you son of a bitch. I wish you were dead. And I said, what? He said, well, you asked me. Now, let me tell you. He said, not only do I wish you were dead, everybody wishes you were dead. He said, especially your wife. I just paid your insurance premiums. He says, wait a minute, I said, no, he says, I'm going to kill you. He says, you know, I've got an incurable progressive terminal disease. I'm going to go mad or die unless I live a life of love and of service at some personal sacrifice without thought of reward every day. And I can't think of anything that causes me more personal sacrifice than to love and serve you. Now, that, ladies and gentlemen, is the essence of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It really is. And who wants to do that? Nobody. We're not going to love and serve anybody if we can help it. Our whole life has been just to the contrary. We want everybody to love and serve us. We spend all of our life building, in the modern phrase, an image. For years, I wanted a good credit rating, and it never occurred to me to pay my bill. It's an amazing thing. Well, Emerson puts it very beautifully. He says, men cultivate appearances because the substance is not. That means you're a phony. And this is what we are. And it takes a complete reversal in trying to manipulate people to think we are good from being good and not caring what they think. And this is what it takes. And if we do live a life of love and of service, if we are kind, honestly, open-mindedly, and willingly, if we do this at some personal sacrifice, especially in the area where we are most gifted by the God that I have come to understand, that is, in the expression of what's wrong with us and how to get well to those of us who are coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. If we do that, we get well and we stay well. And more than that, we become a part of the love of the God that I have come to understand. My God must necessarily be compassionate, forgiving, with a sense of humor, as I've indicated, marvelously wiser beyond and more powerful beyond any concept that I can have. A God that can bring me to moments like this, in a room like this, with people like you. And in whom is this very God that I speak? You may not even know he's there, but if you're an alcoholic and you're sober, you didn't do it. The God that I have come to understand did it. And I come to these meetings, and I love these meetings because they give me the two aspects of our disease, physical and mental. They remind me that I'm not normal. When I look at you physically, you're not normal either. They remind me that you are sober because you don't take a drink, and that you have the power to keep from taking a drink because of this God that is within you and that I see, and whose blessing I invite on every one of you.
I join with everyone else in this auditorium in thanking you for being with us tonight. Also tonight, I'd like to thank the Reverend Mr. Watson, Mary Livingston, who is with us, for the address of welcome, Bobby S. for reading the first portion of Chapter 5, and Ben E. for being with us to read the traditions. Also again, I invite everyone to return tomorrow at 1 o'clock in the afternoon to hear Clyde D. of El Monte. Thank you very much for being with us tonight. We will now close the meeting in the usual manner, and those who wish to join us in reciting the Lord's Prayer.